You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry. Our guest today is Samara Bay, a speech and dialect coach with clients ranging from the stars of Wonder Woman and Guardians of the Galaxy to candidates running for Congress, pitching their startup, or speaking at the UN. She is the writer of the upcoming nonfiction book, Permission to Speak, which will be published in 2023 by Crown, a division of Penguin Random House.
When you got pregnant and you had your son, your career as a dialect coach wasn't quite off the ground yet, but you became a parent and soon after was presented with an incredible job opportunity. As a fellow working mom, I would love to hear what that decision-making process was like for you.
I had this chance to go off to Richmond, Virginia, and I live in LA, so that's not nothing, for 2 months for my child's fourth through sixth month of life. And it was to work on Loving, which was a really special movie with Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga, who are both non-Americans. So as a dialect coach, it's also just a meaty job to coach them on a very specific regional North Carolina accent. And also there's biographical data out there. There is stories about the real life people that they were portraying. And then I also had this newborn. So I knew I kind of needed to take the job. And I also knew that it was bringing stuff up. And I remember I had this moment with my mom, who in my mind is sort of a sort of perfect crunchy earth mother who had me at home in Bay Area, hippie Santa Cruz, California. And so I thought she'd be a good person to run this by. And I said, what if I am not, you know, going to be able to be there enough for him in his first few months? What if I had been until then exclusively breastfeeding? And, you know, no judgment either way at all, truly, but I was interested in keeping it up because my body seemed to be up for it. And I said, what if I'm not going to be able to keep doing that because set life is 12-hour days? She said, the best thing for a baby is a happy mom. And at this point, I think that might actually be a cliche. I feel like I've now heard that a lot of places, but at the time I had not heard anybody say that. And it hit me. It actually still hits me every time I say it out loud, because it is not, even though I say it's a cliche, it's not actually said enough, I think, or it's said, but not really believed in our bodies. And so we don't actually make choices that put our happiness first. And I did. And I will say it was an incredible experience, partly because of what happened on set, in terms of those relationships, in terms of that work, in terms of the huge amount of support that I had from the producer, but it was also partly great for parenting. There is something healthy about missing your kid. There's something healthy about feeling like you have a purpose and then you also get to come home and have a different purpose. So, wow. I mean, I learned so much in those first few months of parenting about the value of work and about the value of really diligently not putting my kids' needs first, because actually we don't always have the clearest sense of what they need. Now, 7 years later, he absolutely knows, you know, mom has work. Mom loves work. Mom has me. Mom loves me. They're not mutually exclusive.
What made it work while you were there? What kind of support did you have? What really helped you?
I had a really awesome husband, combined with a really awesome mother-in-law who switched out when the husband had to go back to LA to do some work. And I had a really awesome babysitter in LA named Lala, who I said, would you be interested in, if I flew you out and paid you weekly, would you be cool being a quote unquote nanny for a few weeks? And she was super into it. I mean, obviously I pitched it as an adventure and it was, but you know, I remember the producer on set, not the one I mentioned, but a different producer, a male producer who was cheeky and funny, but he did give me a lot of crap for having a quote unquote nanny. How very LA of me, he said. Let me just clarify. He didn't have a kid at the time. Now he has a kid and he's actually apologized to me. It was, you know, it was like light teasing, but it really stuck, because I was like, how? How does any woman of child rearing years do a 12 hour set day without support. They don't. And then you're creating an industry that doesn't have women. So hi. I had a lot of support and I had a lot of, snuggles with the kid at weird hours. You know, they use walkie talkies on a film set and it's in the inner ear of a lot of the crew. And at some point, and only once, I was not where I should have been at the right time. It's hard to predict. And I think the kid was visiting and I went aside to, breastfeed him. And it turned out to be the wrong moment. They reshuffled the schedule, et cetera. One of the actors asked for me. I wasn't available. And a production assistant ran over to tell me, oh, the actor needs you. And then he saw what was happening, which was fine. But then he said into the walkie, she's breastfeeding. And, you know, I didn't mind. I'm like here to normalize. But it was so funny because they have all these like codes over the walkie for people to go pee because they don't want to use the word pee. And then for poop because they don't want to use the word poop. But obviously, you know, I'll just call it out. One doesn't exist for she's busy breastfeeding.
I love it. There's no code for that.
No. Weird. It probably was never needed again on that set or by any of those groups.
Well, hopefully it is.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Is hopefully we're moving into a place where, yes, now we've got a code for it because women just have babies on sets. And sometimes those women are feeding their babies from their bodies.
From your lips. But I don't see a huge shift in that trend over the 7 years since then. Ultimately, this is about daring, with breath, with belief, with our arms around each other and our hands resting on each other's backs. We must do this work, each of us, for ourselves, but we must not mistake that for doing it alone. The first step in opening a door into any space not made for us is to take a deep breath and to will ourselves to hear, in the silence, the collective breath of millions of others. Daring us on.
So when you were working on the set of Wonder Woman, your alma mater, Princeton, invited you to give a talk at a women's conference they were hosting. And you titled that seminar, How to Use Your Voice to Get What You Want. Over 400 women signed up for that conference, so many that the event had to be moved to a different space. Why do you think a talk about using your voice resonated so deeply with women?
Here's what I learned that day is the answer to that question. Most of us have, maybe all of us have, a relationship with our voice that's a bit toxic. I don't even mean that we hate our voice, although that resonates with a lot of people, but I mean that we have a complicated relationship to how we sound and especially to how we sound in public. Sometimes it manifests itself in just the super basic, I don't like the sound of my voice, but sometimes it's more like somebody once told me that my voice is annoying and I don't believe them, but maybe a little bit. Or Hillary Clinton ran for office and was called shrill over and over and over. And that's misogyny. But wait a second, was she shrill? And we are constantly balancing this weird inner conversation with ourselves where we're trying to be really honest about what we're hearing ourselves. But we also don't have anyone to sort of bounce it off of. And then we sometimes think we're all alone. And I have had the lucky position as a speech coach, first for actors and then more and more for scientists, for founders of startups, for women running for office for the 2018 midterms, and then again for 2020. I've been in this position of working with enough people that I can say pretty confidently that this is not a personal failing. Our relationship to our voice, our weird, icky relationship to our voice. It is systemic. The toxicity is not us. The toxicity is, I'll just say, white supremacy, patriarchy, colonial messaging about what expertise should sound like. And that serves some people more than others. And the more that I work, especially with women, especially with people of color, especially with immigrants for whom English is their second language, or they have a complicated relationship to accent, queer folks, anybody who has just had a lifelong confusion with, like, I don't see or hear anybody who looks or sounds like me in power. Well, hi, the power is the problem. The history of power is the problem, not them. And I gave people space to talk about this. And I didn't know that's what I was doing for that Princeton conference because it was my first time running something like this. But the offer was there and they said it was going to be like a 50-person workshop. And then, as you say, it turned into this huge thing. And so I got to sit with, like, well, this is surprising market research that I was not actually conducting, but here it is. And it was an hour 15 and I did talk about the patterns I've seen across people. But then I also was really curious about keeping a little bit of that workshop energy by turning it back on the audience at around the halfway mark and saying, but literally your question, Casey, literally saying, but why are you here? What do you need to know about how to use your voice to get what you want? And also, let's unpack what it means to get what we want. Like, does that mean to get heard? Does that mean to get the job? Does it mean to avoid having anybody tell us our voice is annoying? Those are actually really different needs or wants, and they're all valid. So what I found from that one day, which really turned into a podcast of my own and a book proposal and now a book that's going to come out in a few months, what I really found out from that day is that when you offer just some, not even the perfect, language and space and sense of solidarity around unpacking this voice toxicity, people take it. They're hungry for it. They didn't know that they were hungry for it. They didn't know. Most of you listening might not have, you know, woken up today and thought, God, I just wish I had a space to talk about my relationship with my voice. And yet when we're offered it, it tends to kind of give us a real sense of permission that changes the next thought that we utter and the next. Empowerment gurus and memes everywhere say, find your voice. But we don't talk enough about why these voices of ours may have gone missing. We don't talk about why exactly it's hard to give ourselves permission to speak. Spoiler alert, it's not our fault. There's a certain kind of voice we've all grown up hearing that sounds like command and conviction. It's John F. Kennedy in the clips we watched in school and Winston Churchill's rousing wartime oratory. It's Steve Jobs delivering his famous Stanford commencement speech and Tom Hanks sitting on the late night couch, charming everyone, and Stephen Colbert bantering with him across the desk. Look, it's not their fault either. They just said what they came to say. But these men, these straight, white, rich, remarkably large men, have defined easy authority for generations. They are what being taken seriously sounds like. They are who a whole lot of our parents and their parents and their parents reflexively offer the benefit of the doubt. They are who we tend to believe. They are our experts and anchors and leaders and heroes. They represent the standard voice of authority as much as a symmetrical, light-skinned, youthful appearance represents the standard of beauty. Even if we know ogling dumb Photoshop pictures of models in magazines and influencers on social media will only make us feel inadequate. Sometimes, when we're not being vigilant, we don't even realize we're doing it. We just don't like the way we look. The problem with the voice standard is the same. When you or I want to become experts or leaders, we are stuck trying to approximate the speech of powerful men, just as we might feel stuck spending too much time debating injections or trying to lose that extra weight. And maybe you don't even realize you're doing it. You just don't like the sound of your voice. That's how standards work. They're everywhere. So like fish, you don't notice the water.
So many writers who take to the pen because they aren't comfortable with their voices and because that's a way to edit in a way that you can't edit in the moment when you're speaking.
They're just so different. Like this sort of extemporaneous conversation, especially compared to writing, where you do, of course, get to edit and edit and edit and make sure that your logic really flows and maybe even have a good editor and make it better. But what no one talks about with this sort of extemporaneous conversation is that it's sort of meant to be messy. Like, the act of trying to figure out something from the inside of us that feels true out requires that we put words to something that doesn't have words. Our feelings, our half ideas, our images of the past. And the act of trying to put words to the thing that doesn't have words is something we do collaboratively in conversation. And we're allowed to, I mean, I'm literally doing it right now, right? We're allowed to go, I just tried some words out. They felt, mostly good. How about you? Did it work? Did it communicate? Oh, I can tell from your faces it did, you know, like, and then if it doesn't, someone says, I don't know what you mean. And then you go, I must not be saying it right. Or you say, perhaps if you are being a little bit more loving, let me try again.
So after that talk, a podcast was born. And then after that, a book proposal.
The same week that I pitched this podcast to iHeartRadio and they bought it in the room and it was a big deal moment for me, another wild thing happened. I was at my women's co-working space in LA that doesn't have a brick and mortar anymore because of the pandemic. But it was like Brigadoon. It just popped out of the fog for a wild time to give me some delightful career boosts. And one of them is that that very week, a friend of mine at the women's co-working space introduced me to her lit agent, who was just popping through town, like New York book agents do. And he heard a bit about what I was working on because I had just pitched it. I was in real, you know, mode. And he said, I think there's a book in you. And I said, what? In my head. But out loud, I said, oh, cool. And over the next year, while I was dialect coaching on sets and while I was developing the podcast, he and his junior agent helped me with what this proposal might be. Because really, it doesn't often go in this direction. I think often people start with a proposal and then they query and try to get representation, right? And what a lucky break. But you know, I had not done the work on what a proposal would entail. And I remember a great moment very early on where I said to my amazing lit agent and junior lit agent, would you guys show me a few samples of some proposals that sold? And they said, no. And they were right, because what came to pass was a really unique proposal with a structure that matched my thought process. And I don't think that would have happened otherwise. They asked me very early on to do some simple assignments. I mean, boy, do they know how the artist mind works, right? They really didn't overwhelm me. They said, make a list of 50 ideas that you're pretty sure when you coach, you made up. Make a list of 50 ideas that you're sure that when you coach and you mention, you didn't make up, you would like to credit. 50 people you would like to interview or discuss, and 50 statistics that are valuable to support the sort of work that I'm talking about. And I took that assignment and I slashed them all down to 25. And then I did it. And then I began to see themes that emerged. And I'm truncating time here because I definitely sat on it for a while because I hadn't quite convinced myself that I was capable of this. But eventually I cut out, I mean, all over my floor, really like comically analog, the different ideas that had popped up from that assignment and began to group them literally on the carpet. During a shower, as I think happens for us creative folks, the entire 8-chapter structure of the book came about in my mind. And I believe I actually grabbed my phone and hit record and was like, I hope my phone doesn't die. But I did try to keep it out of the water. But I put that together into an annotated table of contents. Again, had no precedent for this. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did it. And when I handed over that plus a manifesto that sort of came out of me during a 4-hour window of time that I had when I put myself on a timer, when I handed those things to my lit agents, they signed me. until then, it was sort of on spec, which was fair, right? Because I was a little bit dicking around and clearly dealing with my own mind gunk, as I call it. And they kind of knew, and I kind of knew when the moment happened of, ooh, now I know what this is. And from there, it took 2 months to the day till the proposal was done. They said, write a 5-page essay on each of those chapters. And that was so painful. But from Labor Day weekend of 2019 to Halloween of 2019, while I was on set for this TV show, Them, which is about really heavy racial themes, and I was coaching the two leads, and I was on set every day sitting on a, oh my gosh, sitting on a fake AstroTurf lawn leaning against a white picket fence. I wrote the proposal.
That's pretty hardcore.
It was so weird. Nice. But it did it, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool that you got such great guidance. That's almost like a little bit more of like a manager role that your lead agents.
It's really
took with
special.
You.
It's true really developmental cool. work mm-hmm. that they did. And I think they pride themselves on that. And I didn't know, you know, because I'd missed the step where I was trying to figure out who would be the right agent for me or something, you know. I did talk to a friend of mine from college who's in the publishing world at some point that year, and he said that my agent is, quote unquote, the best of the best. So a true lucky break.
And you proved yourself, though, by handing over that assignment and, like, you know, reinforcing what they originally saw and showing, like, because it's not just the brilliant ideas. It is the hard work matching with that, and that's really cool.
Yes, thank you, Casey. My luck might be meeting opportunity when it finds me. I was really ready, but it also was just the luck of being in the right place at the right time and having a friend who had this incredible connection and her choosing in the moment to do that sisterhood thing she did not need to do.
Preparation meets opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's the line I was looking for. Yes.
You were prepared and you had an opportunity, and it requires both. So yeah. A lot of people get lucky things, but if they're not prepared for them, they won't translate into anything successful, or for not for very long. Easy come, easy go.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I mean, obviously I don't want to overuse the word luck and undervalue myself, but I also am partly using the word lucky to say privileged, because there was just some like, you know, if I couldn't have afforded that co-working space, if I wasn't friends with a TV writer star who has this fancy agent, you know, like it was a lot of like, okay, but you're absolutely right that I could have squandered it. And I actually was in danger of doing so. You know, I took a while on that assignment.
And I want to hear, you have a story about how it sold, because you also had a very unique experience with selling your book. And I want to hear that.
So the proposal was done, as I said, around October, and then we took a few months to just tweak it, make it better, and they thought, well, you should hold on to it for the new year and then send it out for potential publisher interest. And now we're in early 2020. So they thought, let's send it out right around the time my podcast actually releases into the world, which was February. They sent it out. A global pandemic hit, and my trip to New York to meet with publishers seemed like sort of a fantasy that was quickly dissipating. And I remember literally thinking, who cares about women and voices? The world is falling apart. Let me just take a second to mourn what could have been here. And instead, they came out hard. And I was all of these publishers' first Zoom meeting with an author, with a potential author. And I didn't know how much interest there was until I got my final schedule of who I was going to meet with the week of March 23rd, 2020. And the answer is 14 publishers. And I pitched the heck out of this over Zoom and figured out what pitching this book even is. Because once somebody has read a 75-page document and said, I want to meet with you, they don't actually need me to tell them anything new. They need me to show them that I'm fun to work with, that I wrote it myself, and that I care. The end of the story is there was a 13-way bidding war on that Friday.
That's amazing. Yeah. And was it up to you? Like, was it just definitely highest bid, or was it partially the relationship you wanted to have? And what was that decision like?
Yeah, it's a great question. I didn't have to deal with the complication of that answer because the two of the people I was the most interested in just from those meetings were the highest bidders, and they were both inside of Penguin Random House in different divisions, so they couldn't bid against each other. The number was the same. And then there was a third bidder who I was less interested in that was in the same range, but a little lower. But had I been more interested, I would have gone with the lower money, I think, because, you know, who you work with for 2 years quite intimately on your first book, maybe, and for
your
all your books. But
you want it to be in good hands.
That's right. That's right. And I will say that the decision between those two who are wonderful was very hard. But I don't know if anyone else here has had this experience, but in the process of them counter bidding on each other, on me, they both wrote letters to me like I was a house. And I had the weekend to decide by reading these letters. And the spirit of those letters made it completely clear, because one of them had a little bit more of a challenge energy. If we were to work together, I would need you to show me. And I was really intrigued by her, but that letter just felt like, this is hard enough. Besides having the person who's supposed to be my biggest advocate and deliberately positioning herself as someone I had to keep proving myself to. Whereas the other one who, you know, big surprise I ended up going with, I'll say this, she started her letter by saying, go with me on this, Samara. You're not a public speaking coach, you're a revolutionary. And this book is not about public speaking. It's going to break the glass ceiling in America.
So it was spring 2020, and you had just landed this book deal. So then you have to write a book during a pandemic, which meant that you also just lost your childcare for your four-year-old son. How did you ultimately get that book out?
Oh my God. Okay, here's the practical answer. First of all, my husband and I decided early days, I would take the 4 hours in the morning and he would take the 4 hours in the afternoon to write or work, because I'm a way better thinker in the mornings.
Wow. My husband and I did something very similar.
There you go.
You had to just break the day.
We just did. We were like, it's an 8 hour work day.
Yep.
You take the kid in the mornings, which meant that my husband, by the way, literally did Zoom kindergarten. I was not a part of that experience. And I got to write in the mornings, and my 4 hours ended up being, if we're totally being honest, a little longer than four, and his were fewer than four. But I also was very much the one on a, you know, deadline. And I would take the kid in the afternoons, and sometimes I would try to do work while he sort of independently played, and I tried to encourage that. But often I would really, really, really just try to embrace the fact that if I could go on a walk with him in nature, that was not just bonding time with him, but also self-care for me and an opportunity to work on balance, which, like, let's be honest, we all need to work on. A few other essentials. One, I went on a few really good Airbnb retreats for myself. One really early on where I sat in a hot tub and asked myself a lot of questions with a recorder on about what is public speaking? Why? What is the voice? Why am I interested in this? Like, really getting to the heart of these things that have been swirling around in my life for literally my entire life. Like, I was obsessed with Marilyn Monroe and Eliza Doolittle when I was like 8. How people present in the world and how their voice has to do with that presentation is obviously deep in me. And yet I hadn't really interrogated myself. And so I did that, you know, in those early days when I couldn't necessarily trust that I was ready to, you know, put whatever metaphorical pen to paper, I was ready to start asking myself these big questions and get at something true that felt really foundational. Other things I did, made a rule that was awkward but great to my husband, that he remains not allowed to knock on my door during my 4 hours. If he needs me for some real reason, text me. It'll pop up on my computer screen. But a knock, for me, for how my brain works, not even the knock, the idea that he could knock, the anticipation of a knock was enough to keep me from going into a flow state. And when I allowed myself the permission, by the way, my book is called Permission to Speak. When I allowed myself the permission to say this sort of mean but true thing of, I need you to not interrupt me. I need you to respect that this time is my time. He got it. But he did need to be told that. We were just work from homing together on top of each other, you know? Another piece I would love to say of practical advice, but honestly, I am probably the only person who could pull this off in exactly this way. But in the fall of 2020, when I was 6 months into my year and a half deal and I hadn't really written quote unquote pages yet, and my editor was starting to get a little nervous. I'd been writing essays and sort of calling it writing the book, but it wasn't really. Just when that was starting to become a little bit of a concern, I got the opportunity to spend a different 2 months on set with Gal Gadot, not for Wonder Woman, but for Red Notice, with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Ryan Reynolds. And it was this just ambitious attempt to get the first big budget American movie back up and running in our country during the pandemic before there was a vaccine. And the requirement was, you leave the bubble of your family, you go to the bubble of Atlanta, you go to the bubble of this crew, you sign away your life rights, you get a QR code on your rental car, and you either are in the hotel or you're on set, but literally nowhere else. And if your QR code shows that you took a minute longer than anyone else took to get there that day, you'll be asked why. I said yes to that job, even though 2 months on the other side of the country for my family was weird and awkward and quite honestly sad, because it was a writer's retreat and I was not allowed to go anywhere. So on the days that Gal literally didn't have words, I would be home in this hotel room with a lovely view of nature, trying to draft the first half of my book.
I really think that that speaks so – it just speaks volumes to what mothers and parents experienced in the pandemic. Like that you had to literally remove yourself from the situation in order to do the important work that needed to be
done. That's totally it. And I knew – I mean, I knew literally because I had conversations with mom friends here in LA who were either like, oh, my God, that would kill me, or, oh, my God, can I please go with you? Yeah, and, you know, I almost like went on behalf of all of us. Because I was like, who – at that point, like 8 months in, all of us were like, I need a fucking second. And I took it. You know, and it actually was supposed to be a month and a half. And then they added 2 extra weeks on, and Gal specifically requested, and she has kids and she gets it and she got it. And she was like, if you have to go, I get it. And I was like, at this point, what's 2 weeks?
Let me just get one more chapter.
Yeah. I mean, my goal was to draft half of the book, which is 4 chapters out of 8. And I almost succeeded. One of those chapters was a beast and was the only one that required like abandon, come back, abandon, come back, abandon, come back 4 times until I finally was complaining to my aunt one time really, really late in the game when I just needed to have this book done. And I said, the problem with this chapter, which, by the way, is about emotion. So like not a big subject. Is that, you know, I started down these routes and down these paths and now, oh, and all the data and the things I have to teach myself. And she said, my aunt said, write what makes you feel good. And I was like, no, you don't understand. And she said, write what makes you feel good. I heard her and I really had a recalibration in that moment where I was like, this is my book. It's not anyone else's. And also no one is obligating me to do anything I don't want to do. That is power that I'm actually not claiming.
So I have an 18-month-old, and I'm sure like many toddler parents or those that have gone through the toddler years, I am obsessed with trying to understand her and how to best communicate with her, read her behavior and emotions that are so high right now. And so I want to ask your thoughts on how does our voice connect to our role and the tools that we have as a parent.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I have two answers for two different stages. When my kid was that little, I remember my husband and me having this sort of ongoing, lighthearted competition where we would try to talk to our kid like a grown-up. And if we thought, if one of us was alone in a room and the other was in a different room with the kid, and we thought that our partner was like on the phone with a grown-up, then they won. No one has to follow this competition, but it did set a precedent that we really talked to our kid like a person, which, you know, there's data across cultures that our voice goes up when we talk to babies. Nothing is wrong with that. It's very instinctual, and obviously it's deep rooted in our psyche. And sometimes we can get stuck in that and talk down to kids when actually they're ready to be talked to like people. And I don't know exactly when that time is, and it's probably different for each of us. But my husband and I just really started off on, you know, an interesting foot with that. And I think it served us and our kid really well. And then the other thing is when they are verbal, when they are in a real conversational mode. And I'm thinking like around the time that the pandemic hit for us. So, you know, in the 4 or 5 range where they're really having complex conversations and really learning a lot about how the world works from the conversations that you have with them. One of the things that I think has been the biggest influence on my parenting and on how I use my voice to talk to my kid and expect him to use his voice to talk to me is my acting background. The idea that we don't get to just say what we want, but that we have to, there's a second half to how we communicate. It's not just what we want, our urge to communicate, but it's also how we have to say it in order to get our need met. And the how part of it in a corporate context can feel really frustrating. Like, ugh, why do I have to say, you know, why do I have to speak in this, you know, unintimidating way in order to get my boss to like me and not call me shrill? But the reality is, and it's, I was super confronted with it as a parent, this is actually what it is to human in a civil society. We, none of us, there's probably some exceptions that are quite disheartening, but almost none of us can just spew what we think and what we want with no thought at all about packaging it for the ears that we want it from. And teaching my kid that has been really gratifying. So he'll say, you know, I want water. And I'll be like, cool, cool, cool. How would you go about getting it? That's the first part. What's the second part? It's a little like tactics in the acting world, right? How do you get what you want? Well, you try different ways, tactics. And it can feel manipulative, but actually it's really like, what does your listener need? Because they have needs too. At the start of quarantine, our little dog, Moxie, was suddenly my kid's only companion. The high-energy 4-year-old kept trying to pick the dog up, move her body, or get her to sit by whining, come on, or pushing her backside down. It was rough. One day, when Moxie was getting particularly aggrieved at his advances, and I was getting particularly concerned because even little dogs will bite if threatened, I said, my love, you can't control others. You can only convince them. He looked at me. Bright eyes. And using his most determined voice, he said with optimism, Moxie, sit. And she sat. I thought back on all the times I had told my kid to use his quote unquote strong voice when he would get whiny with me. But the dog taught him the lesson better than I ever could. Tone of voice matters.
Did your voice change at all once you became a mother?
I don't think my actual voice changed, but I think my relationship to my voice changed. I really discovered that balancing strength and warmth, which is discussed a lot in leadership, they feel like they're not opposites, but they're very hard to do both at the same time. We can either seem really strong or really warm. And there's all kinds of data to support that when we are too strong and let me say it differently. There's all kinds of data to support that if we happen to be better at one than the other, wonky things happen. We get called terrible names. We get dismissed, etc. And I found how to balance my strength and warmth when talking to my own child. And that made me feel like, oh, I can mine the way that I am actually in a leadership capacity over here in my household for how Samara, the leader, might show up in other spaces. And I find that most of us discount the ways that we are leaders to our kid, that we are strong and warm. This is what I need. And I love you very much. And how we can bring that with us, that energy with us, into more complicated spaces with peers.
What advice would you offer other writing parents who are balancing multiple aspects of their own careers?
I talked to a friend of mine who's a creativity coach. Cool job. Her name is Liz Kimball. Early in the writing process, about what it is to sort of sit down to write on a schedule, to have to be creative on cue. And especially with the pandemic and the 4 hours a day, you know, it was sort of non-negotiable. And it felt hard. I mean, for all the obvious reasons that writing is hard and that we all hate it, even though we love it. But also, the world was falling apart and we couldn't show our kids how bad it was. And I was writing a book that I had promised was going to be deeply optimistic. And I didn't always feel up for that. And then I felt self-pity, which I knew I was not allowed to feel because of the lucky, lucky situation I was in. So that was all very alive. And Liz said, you know, we can't just build towards something beautiful in an ugly way. We can't push and muscle our way into something beautiful. We have to actually sit down beautifully to do it. And that idea that actually I wasn't just helping us towards a more just and equitable and voice-free world, but that I actually needed to hold myself accountable to showing up like the version of me that would feel joy in the future. You know, it's a tall order, but like that was great advice. Here's how it translated in practical terms. Don't sit down when you're in a shitty mood and feel like you have to muscle out something bad. Jump up, do some yoga, turn on some music that makes you feel joy, think about something that makes you smile, change your state, take responsibility for your state before you sit down. And know that you can. Know that we actually have the ability. If we don't, if we're really raw, if the news has been particularly bad, fine, call it. But if we can, the effort should be not in pushing through to write something crappy. The effort should be in convincing ourselves that we are worth sitting down with joy, doing what we must do for about 5-10 minutes in the morning so that we will. And that was the number one most useful thing. And I still do that now whenever I do any public speaking or anything. I like take those few minutes beforehand because I know that, you know, centering my joy is going to make me more interesting and have more fun. It will make more creative stuff come out.
What were your son's first words?
Doggy and truck. But I don't think he could say the R. So it was like tuck, tuck. And my husband and I were like deathly afraid that he would never be able to tell the difference between a car and a truck because everything was a tuck. And we were like, will he ever know? Spoiler alert, dear listeners, he knows.
What was the first thing you said when you saw your son?
I have no idea. It was a very complicated birth. I do know that the first time he cried, I started singing Hush Little Baby. I thought, it's a classic that I don't know the words to, and you have to sort of make them up after the second line. Just make them up every time.
What are the first words of your current project?
The introduction begins with a quote from Mary Beard, who is a British classicist who wrote a manifesto called Women and Power. And she said, what we need is some old-fashioned consciousness raising about what we mean by the voice of authority, quote unquote, and how we've come to construct it.
What is the first word that comes to mind when I say breath?
I mean, it's the first chapter of my book, so I totally just was like, it's everywhere.
Perfect. Story.
Teller.
Play.
Act.
Leap.
The first word that came down was bounds. And then I thought, God, it's so cliche.
Conflict.
Resolution.
Mother.
Father.
Power.
Struggle.
You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com. If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.